It's Friday, May 6, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Last night in South Carolina, the nation's first Republican presidential debate of the 2012 presidential election season was held. Five participants and actually very little attention. Only one of those who showed up, former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, is considered a frontrunner for the Republican nomination. But then again, who exactly should be considered on the list of frontrunners for that Republican nomination? We need to remember that politics is an ongoing business. Americans tend to think of presidential elections when they happen, sometimes looking ahead, sometimes looking back. We tend to think of politics when we have to make a political decision, when there's a front-edge, front-burner political issue that is burning and demanding attention. But we tend to let politics recede into the background of our lives as we deal with raising our children, doing our jobs, doing the things that we're called to do in this world. But politics as an industry is ongoing, and it has its own cycles. And the main cycle in America is the re-election cycle. And the top of the heap in terms of those cycles is, of course, the election of a president every 4 years. So this is what's really remarkable about what happened and what didn't happen in that Republican debate. Number one, the front-running candidates didn't, by the main, show up. But then again, who exactly are the front-running candidates? If anything, the 2012 season on the Republican side is demonstrating the fact that this is a very unusual political moment. It appears that there is not, at this point, a frontline team of Republicans who are, at this point in the political season, ready to commit themselves to run against President Barack Obama after they run against each other. Now, if that seems unusual, it's because it is. If you rewind the political election cycles just two or three times, you'll discover that it has been inching in the other direction in terms of the calendar. Declarations have been coming earlier and earlier. Clear intentions have been evident earlier and earlier. Stepping back, for instance, from 2008 to 2006, when it was pretty clear that Barack Obama was going to be running for the office of President of the United States, and when most people thought that Hillary Clinton was the frontrunner for that nomination race. But on the Republican side for the 2012 election, it's cloudy at best. It's very unusual. This could be a moment of unique opportunity, or it could be a signal of the fact that we are in a very stagnant political season. It's going to be interesting to see, with all of the issues that are at stake. One of the big questions, and it's the same question that came down to the British elections just a few months ago, is this. Does anyone really want to take on this responsibility, knowing the gravity of the decisions, very difficult decisions, politically costly decisions, that are going to have to be debated and made over the course not only of the next presidential administration, but of this campaign? This may be one of the most bruising political presidential campaigns in American history. Time will tell. But that may explain why the stage in South Carolina last night was rather spare. Speaking of things that didn't happen, at this point a good deal of the discussion around the world is about the photograph that wasn't released. The photograph of the body of Osama bin Laden. Now, from a perspective of politics, it appears that the White House has bungled, at least, that discussion by allowing it to become a public issue of consideration and by showing the dissension within the administration on a question of such grave and tremendous political importance. But there's another aspect of this that ought to have a particularly Christian angle. Christians, going all the way back to the earliest periods of the church, honored life and understood the gravity of death through means of what we would now call a funeral service. The distinction between a funeral service and a memorial service is generally the fact that at a funeral service, the body is present. As a young child, I often wondered why in the world the casket was open. Why is it that we had something that was even called, in my part of the country, a viewing, where people came to actually view the body? From a Christian perspective, it is this. We understand that the person is indistinguishable from the body. We are embodied creatures. We understand that there is a clear distinction between life and death. And there is something within us that needs to have the closure that comes by seeing the body in the repose of death. It is not cruelty. It is not some kind of macabre fascination. It is instead the recognition that death is a very important issue, indeed the last enemy. There is something psychologically and even theologically appropriate about that. And thus, even as the world is concerned with proving whether or not it is Osama bin Laden, as if a photograph would prove what the other documentation and DNA evidence might not, it just might get to a basic psychological issue of the necessity of some closure. People will not believe he is dead until they see him dead. And if that's true for Osama bin Laden, it's also true for persons even much closer to us. and known to us. And Christians understand that there is probably a good reason for that. Meanwhile, speaking of good reasons, Pakistan has an excellent reason to try to explain itself and the conduct of that nation over the past several years, as Osama bin Laden was evidently ensconced within a mansion just a matter of about 2,000 feet from one of the premier military installations of that nation. As the Wall Street Journal said yesterday in its headline, signs point to a Pakistan link. In probe of who aided bin Laden, U.S. focuses on Islamabad's military and spy services. Well, if Americans are surprised by that, they ought not to be. Our news media have been faithful over the last several years in pointing to the fact that the American military and political leadership has been pretty clear about the fact that we know that there are holes within that military and intelligence system there in Pakistan that you could literally drive a terrorist through, because it's happened over and over and over again. That's one of the reasons why our relationship with that country, which we give over $4 billion of annual aid, is one that is so tricky and tremulous. Well, Pakistan clearly is on the defensive here. There is no way that Osama bin Laden was there for that length of time, undetected and unaided. And given the fact of his location and the rather significant facility that contained him, there is no doubt that he had aid from someone on the ground and from someone in the intelligence services as well. Meanwhile, while we've been giving all this attention to what's been going on around the world, going back just in recent months to Japan and the tragedies there, then to all the unrest across North Africa and the Middle East, and then, of course, to Pakistan and Osama bin Laden in just recent days, and then financially looking at crises, especially in Western Europe and nations like Portugal and Athens, that is Greece, and other things, we have forgotten that we have neighbors. And one of those neighbors to our north is Canada. And Canada has also undergone a very significant political transformation just in recent days. The recent Canadian election gave a clear majority to Conservative Prime Minister Stephen Harper. This is the first time that Harper, who has survived two previous elections, has a clear majority in Parliament. Previously, he had a plurality and was able to head the government, but he did not have a clear majority. It has been a very long time since Conservatives have had any kind of influence like this in our northern neighbor. It looks like Harper's party has won approximately 308 seats. This means he no longer has to answer to other parties in order to get his legislative package through. Now, when you start looking at this, you realize that this could mean big changes to our north. It also means that the big change in terms of the political culture has probably already happened. Canada has been modeled far more along the lines of Western Europe in terms of how it sees itself as something of a quasi-welfare state. It also has experienced many of the questions, including immigration, that America now faces and has had to deal with them over the past several years. Canada making a turn to the right is something that would have been virtually inconceivable just a matter of about 5 or 6 years ago. It appears that it was for financial reasons that the Canadians gave the Conservatives this majority in Parliament and Prime Minister Harper his first majority so that he can lead the nation in a far more determinative way. This kind of political change is significant when it happens afar. It's even more significant for us when it happens in a neighbor so close. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, that remains to be seen as to whether there's any similar effect in the American population with the 2012 elections coming. But it does certainly say that at least some cultures that had defined themselves in far more liberal terms are now having to re-ask the questions and are making some big political changes. When it comes to sex, Americans talk a lot. It turns out that they also lie a lot. The Vital Statistics column of the New York Times gives us a very interesting insight, and it tells us that those who conduct sex surveys have discovered something that we probably should have known all along. People will answer another human being one way, but a computer very differently. Now, this has some very particular applications, as is reported again in the Vital Statistics column of the New York Times. The first paragraph reads this way: "It is not easy to ask people about their sex lives, and getting honest answers may be even harder, but there are ways to do it. One good method is to have a computer ask the questions while the interviewee listens through earphones and enters the answer on screen without the intervention or even the presence of another human." Let me just give you one fact out of this research, and this is something that probably everyone will understand once you hear it. It turns out that teenage boys and young men, when they're asked about their sex lives by another human being, well, exaggerate. It turns out when they're answering a computer, their report is considerably diminished from what it was when they answered a human survey taker. Now, does that tell us that the moral situation has changed? Of course not. Does it tell us that we really do not have to worry about the kind of sexual licentiousness that we know is taking place on many college campuses and the sexualization even of young teenagers? No, it doesn't mean that. It does mean that when sinners are asked a question about their sin, they'll often brag about it and even exaggerate. Answering a computer, well, you don't get any feedback for the exaggeration. You tend to be more honest. And it turns out that these teenage boys and young men, when they're more honest, turn out that their sex lives are far less interesting than they would say to each other or even to a human survey taker. Meanwhile, in the scientific field, there's an absolutely fascinating story out. It's reported in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal. It's reported in yesterday's edition of the New York Times. And were it not for the fact that there are probably only a few people on the planet who can really understand what this story is all about, we can all understand the headline. "Good thinking, Einstein," said the Wall Street Journal. Researchers spent decades and $750 million affirming his theory of relativity. It's been roughly a century since Albert Einstein developed his special and general theories of relativity. And since then, in that relatively short period of time in human history, but a long period of time academically speaking, where researchers have been trying to prove whether he's right or wrong. They basically believed that he was right, but they weren't certain how to prove whether he was right or wrong, given the size, quite literally, of the questions he was asking. But decades ago, three men in a university swimming pool arguing about Einstein came up with a way to try to prove it, and now 52 years and $750 million later, the longest experiment in space physics ever conducted has concluded that Albert Einstein was right. The theory of relativity has been proved. It has been reported now in the most scholarly scientific circles and also in the major media. And most Americans went along as if it didn't matter. For the conduct of our lives, as it turns out, Einstein's theory of relativity has relatively little meaning. In the big questions of life as to how the cosmos operates, it turns out to be a very fundamental insight. But there are big truths that have little meaning. And there are things that the scientists would say are little truths that have eternal meaning. And there is where we better know the difference. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can find me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again next week for The Briefing.